Truth and Transcendence. Brought to you by Yes, You Now, with Catherine Llewellyn. Truth and Transcendence, episode 44, with special guest Kevin Gaskell. Now, for those listening to this who may not have come across Kevin, Kevin, otherwise known as the Business Fixer, is a serial entrepreneur, author, and adventurer, one of the world's foremost leadership experts, responsible for transforming three of the most iconic international brands, Porsche, BMW, and Lamborghini. A trailblazer in his approach, Kevin has enjoyed three decades of success as a business leader, founding startups, driving turnarounds, and leading major brands in a variety of sectors, including technology, manufacturing, and professional services. He has repeatedly led teams of varying size to extraordinary performance, creating over £3 billion in shareholder value and winning global and national awards. A leading technology entrepreneur and investor, Kevin is chairman at ITS Technology Group, director of Radical Sports Cars Limited, founder and chairman at ICAS, and executive chairman of Amber Health and Safety Technology. Kevin has played international cricket, climbed some of the world's highest mountains, and walked to both geographic poles. In 2020, he was a member of the crew who set a new world record for the fastest row across the Atlantic Ocean. His brilliant book, Catching Giants, packed with leadership wisdom based on this adventure, is available on Amazon, and I understand in the top 20, which is marvellous. In 2024, Kevin will attempt to set a new world record for rowing across the Pacific. So quite a bio, but why did I invite Kevin to Truth and Transcendence? Well, his tremendous energy, commitment to exceeding expectations and living life to the full, along with his astonishing creativity and sheer bottle, and his dedication to empowering others to be great in their own right. Kevin is a thoroughly decent person, and I find him thoroughly inspiring. So, Kevin, thank you so much for finding the time to come and join us on Truth and Transcendence.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you for the invitation. I do get a little bit careful when people describe me in such glowing terms. As they say, your mother believes your CV and your wife laughs at it. But yeah, it's been a journey. It has been a journey.
Yeah, in both literally and figuratively.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think that's quite rare, you know, where somebody is adventuring in a physical sense and, you know, all that activity that you've done, as well as being really quite determined and creative and accomplishing a lot in the business world as well. I think that's quite an unusual combination.
Yes, it does seem to be. But I've always found that, you know, when I'm at work, when I'm running companies, it's a very intense occupation. You know, I work long days and short nights. And I'm currently, as you said, I'm on the board of four or five companies. And I'm building two new ones. So I'm very, very busy. And in order to give myself some respite, I go and do an adventure. Because they can be anything from 3 or 4 weeks to 3 or 4 months, frankly. And I'm fortunate in that I can negotiate the time away from the office. And I go and I kind of, it clears the hard drive, you know. You just get clarity back and perspective back. And so that's why I like to mix the two. Yeah. That's why I do it.
Makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I don't go walking to the North Pole and things like that. But I like to do... I like to dance, you know, sort of improvisational sort of dance. And I find just an evening of that clears my mind. And yeah. I wake up the next day, I'm refreshed.
Absolutely. And you know, playing in the band. I played in the band, the same group of guys now, since 1996. So how many years is that? 26 years with the same group of guys. We had a couple of changes, and it's just great fun. And you know, even when we rehearse, it's just fun and being able to play the instruments and make the music. And we played the other night at a local event, and it was just such fun. So again, that's a similar thing. It's a step away from business.
Yeah,
it's relaxation in its truest form. It's relaxation.
Yeah. And you're using a different part of your creativity as well, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah, it's a different part of your brain. And it's just enjoyable. You know, standing in a five-piece band playing rock music, it's just great fun. It's just great fun.
What do you play?
Well, I play guitar. And we play as a band. We're called the Hods. And the Hods stands for Heads of Department. Because we form together at BMW, and we're all heads of department, and the guys are all very good musicians. I'm far and away the weakest in the band, and the guys have been session musicians and all kinds of things, and we played for the staff at a Christmas party. So there were 500 or 600 people in the audience, and we just came on and played 3 or 4 tracks, and people said to us afterwards, "You weren't playing that, were you? That was miming." We said, "No, we were playing that." No, that was miming. No, we were really playing that. And they were surprised, and as I'll say it, they were surprised how good we were. And I repeat the point, it was the other guys. The other guys are really very accomplished musicians. But it was just great fun. Mm. And so we've played all over. We've played all over Europe. We've played the Hilton on Park Lane as a surprise for an automotive conference. And the faces of the audience who know me, at the time I was chief executive of BMW, and suddenly I've got a guitar strapped on and I'm playing rock music. And I can still see the jaws dropping around the room. It was just great fun.
Fantastic. I love it.
So, yeah, that's what I do outside work.
Brilliant. Well, I think that whole thing of breaking expectations is so valuable, isn't it? Because it's far too easy to get kind of, this is what we believe the world is like. Yeah, but it can't be because my chief exec is on the stage playing rock music.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to rethink your reality a little bit.
Exactly. And you know what? It translates into a kind of change of culture in the business as well, because people see you as human.
Mm.
You know, I was asked to run Porsche when the business was in deep distress, actually. We'd lost 90% of our sales. We were number 32 out of 32 in customer satisfaction.
Oh, dear.
And I had 3 years unsold inventory, 3 years new cars. And just when you think they can't make life any more difficult, they asked me to run the thing. And I was 32 years old. You know, I was as green as grass. But I'd been in the company for 5 years and watched it get itself into trouble. And I tried to stop it. And in the end, the owners of the business, which were the Porsche and the Piëch families, gave me a roasting. And I said, "This is unfair, guys. I'm not running this business. And in any case, you could fix this company." And they said, "What would you do?" And I said, "Well, I'd do this and this and this and this and this." And they asked me to leave the room for 10 minutes, invited me back in, and said, "Right, you're the new managing director. Do what you said." And it was as simple as that. I mean, simple in the appointment. Then I had to turn the business around.
Mm.
But in terms of bringing the culture of being human back into the business, one of the first things I did, which had a big impact on people, was take all the security off the business. So we used to have passes, and you could only get into the director suite if you were given a certain grade, and you could only get into certain areas. Just took all the locks off. And the second thing I did was give people the opportunity to drive the cars. Now, under controlled conditions, but drive the cars. There were people who'd worked for Porsche for 25 years and never driven a Porsche. Right, let's go and do it. So it was a case of humanizing the business in that regard. And you know, the big idea then was, let's turn ourselves back into enthusiasts. Yeah. Let's stop selling cars and let's start selling an experience. And that's what we did. And we turned our business around and became number one in the market within 4 years, both in profitability and in customer satisfaction.
Wow.
With the same team of people, to change anybody. Yeah. We changed the mindset.
Yeah.
And got to love our customers again. So that's what I like to do. I like to make business real, personal. It's about people. Mm. It's about people. And, you know, if we get better, then bigger will come. Too many companies chase big, chase numbers. Stop chasing the numbers. Be world-class at what you should be doing, and the customers will come to you. That's my perspective on it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Love it.
Mm.
Well, I think we could stop there, really. That's just enough wisdom. So you mentioned big ideas, and of course, this month's theme is big ideas on truth and transcendence. And that was one of the things I was really struck by. You know, you deciding to row across the Atlantic is a pretty big idea. You deciding to, or there are a lot of things that you've just mentioned there, which are definitely big ideas. You know, the humanizing of business, being a human being, making the culture more human. You know, you're obviously a man of big ideas. And I think you said to me when we first spoke that you are known as the big ideas man.
Yes, I'm not good on the detail. I mean, I build teams around me who are very good at implementation. Mm. And I firmly believe that most limitations in this world are those that people impose on themselves.
Yeah.
If I had a pound for every time somebody said to me, oh, you watched the North Pole. Oh, I'd love to do that. But, and I say, what's the but? Come on, what's the but? If I can do it, you can do it. Oh, yeah. And then they found 100 reasons why not. And so I said to people, take the but away. You want to do it? Do it.
Yeah.
Let's do it. And you know, the expedition stuff. I mean, I grew up in North Wales and I was climbing mountains from the age of 12, probably. I took my son on his first expedition when he was 12. And it kind of just grew from there. And at first you climb little rock faces and then you climb bigger rock faces. Then you climb a small mountain, then you climb a big mountain. And so Matt and I have gone around the world climbing all over in Europe, in Asia. We've climbed a number of the seven summits now. And it's a progression. And therefore, it's always a challenge. And it's that challenge that excites me. I love to have a challenge. And really, that's where the ocean row came from. If you've walked to both poles and you climb the big mountains, what do you do next? Mm. And I was having this philosophical discussion with a friend of mine who is a professional adventurer. That's what he does for a living. And he said, okay, we should row the ocean. I said, Peter, I don't know anything about rowing. I don't know anything about oceans. I don't sail. I said, I'm a landlubber. He said, you should row the ocean. You'd love it. I said, you're nuts. Forget it. And then I went away, and these words percolated through my brain. You'd love it, Kev. You'd love it. And the more I thought about it, the more excited I became by the prospect. And we pulled the team together. When I got the team together, again, it included my son. I do all this stuff with my son. I'm very privileged to do it with him. And I said, so what's the goal, chaps? And for me, the goal was to get across the Atlantic. And they said, well, we want to break the world record. And I laughed. And I said, look, I'm 60 years old. I said, you're all in your late 20s. I think the eldest was 31 or 32. I said, you're all fit as fiddles. I'm 60 years old. Yeah, I'm fit, but I'm 60. So why don't we do this? Why don't we row across the first time? I'll show you and teach you and lead you to run an expedition. And then you go again and replace me with another 30-year-old and go and break the world record. And they said, no, we're going to break the world record. And the Catching Giants book is the whole story of how five novice rowers, how five novice rowers actually used a business approach, which is what I used, to planning the project, to preparing the boat better than anybody else had prepared theirs, I believe, to planning our route across. And people say, well, isn't it a straight line? It's typically not, because people duck and dive. And we said, no, we're going the shortest distance, and we did. And a whole bunch of other things around the way that we operated as a team, how we did handovers, how we did changeovers, how we fed and watered ourselves. But the biggest difference was the morale on the boat, because there was never a crossword. And if I tell you that on the first night, 50 miles offshore, we thought we were doing pretty well. We got hit by a storm, which was just colossal. I tried to describe it in the book, but it's hard to describe what it's like to be on the inside of a of an Atlantic storm in the winter in an 8-meter plastic rowing boat. And I say it again, rowing boat, because people keep saying to me, well, did you put the sails up? There were no sails. It was oars. And somebody else said to me, well, what about your support vessel? And I laughed. I said, no support vessel, just us. 8-meter rowing boat, 5 guys, 3 sets of oars. That's it. And we got hammered by the storm, which within 20 seconds broke 2 of our oars, 2 carbon fiber oars, just snapped them, just folded them in half and broke them. And so we were completely out of control in the middle of this enormous sea. And it did get a bit spicy for a few hours, I must admit. It was quite interesting. But you learn a lot about people. And that's when the fact that we had a team culture, which nobody was going to panic, everybody pulled together, and we did what we could do to get the boat back under control and fought our way through the night, which is what we did. And in the morning, we had a team meeting. We were still in a massive storm. We had a team meeting and said, well, what are we going to do then? Because we've broken 2 oars. We had 2 spares, but we now have no more spares. What are we going to do? We're going to limp back to land, which is 50 miles backwards. And we said, no, we're going to change the way that we organize ourselves. We're going to row harder than ever, and we're going to carry on. And 36 days later, we turn up in Antigua as world champions. So the for me, the thing about ideas is, I'll say it again, ideas are all about people, engaging people, inspiring people, and encouraging people to help you to achieve something that's extraordinary, because I believe people are extraordinary.
Yeah.
And if I can give them a culture, an organization, a framework upon which they can hang their extraordinary, then together we become world class. And that's all I do. All I do is create the culture. That's all I do.
Yeah. Yeah. That you just said, I believe that people are extraordinary. And I'm not sure everybody believes that people are extraordinary. And I think I also believe that people are extraordinary, by the way. And that idea that people are extraordinary is, I think, one of the biggest ideas there is, because as you say, when that's your assumption, when that's your belief, then everything about the way you conduct yourself and everything about the way you relate to other people is changed, isn't it? It's different.
Yes, it is. You know, outside work, people do incredible things. They might lead sports teams or movie, theater groups, dance groups, whatever it is, people do incredible things. And so my job as a leader is to encourage people to bring those incredible skills into the office. Now, I'm not asking them to come in and dance, but if you can do stuff that's creative, then come and be creative in the business. And so it's allowing people and engaging and inspiring people to give their best. And by doing that, as a team, we become the best we can be. And I'll repeat it again, all I ever do in a business is find clarity. Where are we going? What does success look like? Share that clarity with very simple planning. And anybody who wants to know what a simple plan is, go look at my book, Inspired Leadership, and it's all in there, how we do it. But in that book, when I show people the plan, they go, is that it? And I say, yeah, that's it. Because if you give people thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of project plans, they get confused. Yeah. So we make it really simple. And I often say we handwrite it, because people then engage. Something handwritten is kind of emotional. They'll get it.
Yeah.
And so my job is to get that clarity, have a clear plan in place, and then invite people to contribute, and people will contribute.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I agree with what you say. I have this default belief that people are incredible. Not everybody wants to be incredible, or not everybody wants to be incredible in the role they're in.
Yeah.
And another part of my job in building businesses, and I get asked now to go fix businesses. I've fixed, I think it's 15 companies now, and never by chopping the cost and firing people. Blah, blah, blah. Sometimes you have to do some of that, sometimes, to protect the overall business. Mm. But that's not my default approach. My default approach is, right, let's all get together and see where we can take this business. But sometimes people don't want to be part of that plan. And that's when I will have a conversation with people and say, how can I help you to find your own plan? How can I help you to find somewhere to go that's inspiring, because it's obviously not here, so let me help you to go there.
Yeah.
So, you know, part of building a team is knowing how to engage, but it's also knowing who to gently take out, who doesn't want to be part of that team. And that's fine. And you know what? It doesn't make them bad people. It just means they want to do something else.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, exactly right. In fact, I think I heard you on someone else's podcast saying, okay, there's a project to do. If you want to do it, do it. If you don't want to do it, don't do it.
Yeah.
I thought exactly, well, some people are saying, I can't go to the South Pole because of this, this, and this. Whereas the truth is, I don't actually want to walk to the South Pole.
Yeah. I always break business and projects down into three phases. The first is commit. Are you really committed to do this thing? You know, if you want to row across the ocean, you better be committed to it, because there's no point setting off and getting 10 days out to sea and thinking, I didn't really fancy this in the first place, because there's nowhere to go. Yeah. So the first part is commit. Be absolutely committed to what you're going to do. And that's the same in business. What are we committing to? Well, we're committing to make this business number one in the market or whatever it is. The second piece is connect. That's my simple plan. Connect everybody with a plan. Here's the big idea. When we said we were going to take Porsche from number 32 to number one, people said to me, you're nuts. You're absolutely nuts. And my response to that was, well, tell me what the alternative is. What do you want to be? Do you want to be number 20 or number 15 or number 12 or number 9? What do you want to be? And there's no real answer to that, because if you're not aiming to be number one, you're not continuously improving yourself.
Yeah.
And even when you get to number one, you have to continuously improve. But I like to be in a position where we can connect everybody with that idea. And that's the connect piece. And then the third piece is what I call create. And that's just about creating magic. That's when people are bringing their skills to bear, when you don't have to watch everybody because they're doing their job and they're having fun doing their job. You know, it's got to be fun. So we try to, in our businesses, we try to smile a lot. I mean, we work hard, but we do try to smile. We do have fun and I do believe in treating people as grown-ups. You're a grown-up. But if you don't want to do this job, then say so. And we'll either find a role that suits you more fully, or I'll help you to leave the business. And it's that straightforward.
Yeah.
And it's not a negative. You want to go somewhere else to find your own dream, I'll help you.
Yeah.
You can't be here in this team if you don't want to be part of it. It'd be like having somebody in the boat who said, well, I want to go on the journey, but I don't want to row.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, guys, that's kind of part of the deal. You know, you row for 2 hours and then you get 2 hours off. Well, and then you row another two, and then you get 2 hours off. Because we are rowing 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We never stopped. We stopped. After 19 days, we stopped for half an hour to celebrate New Year, because we went over New Year. We didn't stop for Christmas at all, for no other reason than the weather was good, so we kept rowing. But at New Year, we gave ourselves a break of half an hour. We put our Christmas hats on and we opened the Christmas cards that our families had packed in our kit. And after half an hour, we got back rowing. That was the only time we took a break. So the commitment is the biggest part of it. If people are absolutely committed to the big idea, then my job is to help them to accomplish it. And that's what I do.
Yeah. Fantastic. And in everything you've just said, when you said, people are grown-ups, people are adults, everything you've just said really bears that out. And so often we see leaders who actually don't really think that their people are adults and don't treat them as if they are. I remember once a client said to me, Catherine, we've come up with this great motivational idea for our staff because we think we're not doing enough for them. You know, we're going to give them as a prize for, you know, excelling in their role. We're going to give them this £60 M&S voucher. What do you think? And I said, well, how would you feel if I offered you a £60 M&S voucher for exceeding your goals? And the chief exec looked at me as if to say, what do you mean? I don't understand. You know, it was completely just oblivious to the fact that these were human beings.
Yep.
You know, either give them nothing, or I said, what they really want is for you to actually talk to them as if they're human beings. That's what they really want.
Well, I make a clear point in our businesses that we don't have suggestion schemes for which I pay you. when I employ you to do the job, I employ all of you. And that includes the top 10% where the brain is.
Yeah.
And so I expect you to bring your brain to work, and I invite you to use your creativity and your intelligence and your knowledge to make this business better than it was. And I don't pay you £60 for having a good idea. I'm sorry, I pay you your salary to have a good idea.
Yeah.
Now, when we make the business successful and eventually we sell it or something happens of significance, I will share those rewards with you, and we absolutely do. Every private business I've ever run, there's an equity stake for all the staff, everybody. And should we get an investor or an exit, we sell the business, we pay everybody a big chunk of money. And frequently, if I go into a business and they've not been through any kind of capital restructure before, they don't believe me. They simply don't believe me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he says, but a couple of years down the road, when you give them a check for a year's salary, you know, people suddenly pay attention and they believe.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always done. And it, you know, is it carrot and stick? No, it's not. It's the reality of create value and we can share in that value.
Yeah.
But I'm not paying you a bonus just to come in and do your job. That's not how the world works.
Well, you sound like a fantastic boss, Kevin. But, you know, a fantastic boss who probably doesn't take any nonsense either would be my guess.
Well, I know what my reputation was at BMW. I know what my nickname was. People don't think I know, but I do know. I was known as the Smiling Assassin.
Oh.
And I thought that was pretty unfair because we built a great team culture. But we did have one or two people who were renegades, and it was part of my role, as I said earlier, to find them an opportunity that more suited what they wanted to do. And I used to spend years trying to convert people into my way of thinking, and now I don't. You know, if you want to do it, that's what we just said. If you want to do it, do it.
Yeah.
If you don't want to do it, then let's have a different conversation. Understand whether we've got something you do want to do, or I keep saying it, or go somewhere else. And I sound as if I fire a lot of people. I really don't fire a lot of people. But I'm really, really nice until I'm not. And when I'm not is when I don't think people are pulling their weight. You know, and it would be the case on the boat. Somebody sitting in the row seat, not rowing. Well, you're letting everybody else down. So what's the problem? And let's try and deal with the problem. And if the problem is your commitment, well, you shouldn't have been on the boat in the first place.
Yeah.
So that's how I approach. And I really do treat people, I believe I try to treat people, as human beings. You know, my parents taught me that everybody is somebody's mother, father, sister, brother, son or daughter. Everybody. So treat them with respect. That's my mum and dad. I grew up in a working class background in North Wales. And that was my mum and dad's mantra. Treat everybody with respect. And I do absolutely do that, I believe. And if I fail, and anybody's listening for whom I fail, then I apologize unreservedly. But it was never intentional. So I do just treat people with respect. People want to do a good job. That's another thing. I've never met anybody who wants to come into work to do a bad job. But I've met a lot of people who are doing a bad job. And it's mostly because they don't know what's expected of them. Yeah. So I come back to my commit, connect, create simple plan. What's expected of you is this. And when people can see on a simple plan, oh, okay, if I do that, then that's what happens. I get it. I'll do it. So keep business simple and focus on the priorities. It's too much noise. There's too much noise in the world now.
Oh, I agree.
Social media and the press, you know, proliferation of press. It's just too much noise. So I try to keep the noise out.
Very sensible. Well, you've partly answered the next question I was going to ask you, which was kind of how did you get this way, in a way, is the question. Because what you said about your parents teaching you respect, that's obviously completely registered with you and stayed with you ever since. But what about this aspect of you that connects to big ideas? If you cast your mind back, can you remember the first time that a big idea really landed with you, an idea that turned out to be significant for you going forwards?
Well, my first preschool medical, which I do remember, So I would have been 4 years old. And I remember the doctor asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up, Sonny? And I said, I want to build bridges. I wanted to be a construction engineer. And he said, you know what they're called? And I said, yes, navvies. He said, no, son, they're called civil engineers. And I said, well, I want to be a civil engineer. So that was my first decision. And so I went through school, normal comprehensive education, worked really hard, studied hard, and went to university to read civil and structural engineering. And so getting to university was my first big idea because nobody in my family had ever been to university. Mm. And I was terrified by it. I mean, I was completely overawed by the scale of the university and the number of people. And I think I stayed in my bedroom for about the first 2 weeks. I was just overawed. I came from a little village in North Wales, and it was just thousands of people. So it was all very different and very new to me.
Yeah,
that was my first big idea. My second big idea was I did my engineering degree, and I got a very good degree, and I enjoyed it, and I won the scholarship. And da-da-da-da-da. And then I went out and worked as an engineer, and I was a little bit underwhelmed by what I was doing. And my university offered me a scholarship to read for an MBA. And so I went back to university and did an MBA, which gave me a broader business context to my education. And I really enjoyed that. And I was the youngest on the MBA program by a mile, which is not a positive because I was 23 or something. And, you know, you've got people on MBA programs at late 20s, early 30s, and they'd done 10 years in industry. So I learned so much from them, which I enjoyed. I came out, I changed profession. I became an accountant for about 3 or 4 years, studied accountancy. That was another big idea. I realized I didn't want to be an accountant. And then I joined Porsche. And, it was to get into the automotive sector. I loved cars, and Porsche was my dream car. And I was 10 years at Porsche, 5 years at BMW. And then my next big idea was there's this funny thing called the internet. And I firmly believed, and this is going back now 20 years, I firmly believed that the internet was going to change the way that cars were retailed.
Yeah.
And I could get nobody to listen to me. And I thought, I'll blow this, I'll do it myself. So I quit. I resigned from BMW. And people thought I'd gone nuts. I had probably the best job in the industry. I was 40 years old, 41, whatever I was. And I walked away from the big job with the big office, with the two PAs, with the full-time chauffeur. I mean, it was really quite an extraordinary role. And I went into a rented office with me and a telephone. And I was determined I was going to change the sector. I mean, complete arrogance and idiocy, really. I just thought that this internet thing was going to make a difference. And so we built what today, you hear it today, Cinch and Cazoo and all of these players are now very popular. Well, we did that 20 years ago. I built that 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get anybody to come and be part of it. It was just so far ahead of where they wanted to be. Dealers were terrified of the internet. The manufacturers were terrified of the internet. And so we changed the model slightly and focused on the fleet sector, the Avis, Hertz, these big boys, to help them to run their businesses more efficiently with this platform that we created. And it became a huge success. And it became the number one player in the market. And today I go into any dealership in the UK and our platform is the logo's there stuck on the wall, and I look at it and think, yeah, started that was exciting. And we built it up, and I sold it, and you know, I did all right out of it. I came home, and I said to my wife, well, that's it, I'm done. She said, what do you mean you're done? I said, well, I'm retired. She said, you're 47 years old. I said, yeah, I know. So it's a bit odd, isn't it? Half an hour later, I had an idea for a new business and started that. And I said, I'm on my 15th now.
Wow.
So I build companies. That's what I do. So the big ideas are always pushing for some fresh change. I mean, the one we're building at the minute, I'm building one with my daughter, which is a data security business, which is great fun. So to work with her is just great. She is so capable. She is so good. She's just wonderful. And she's a scientist. She was a research scientist who decided she wanted to come over into technology. And she's running this tech business now. She's absolutely fabulous at it. And she's a young mum with 2-year-old twins, you know, and she's still running this business. She's extraordinary.
Right.
And then I'm building another one with my son, which is about helping young people to build businesses. And that's because, you know, I know at the minute people say, oh, you can't get enough staff for the jobs. Yeah, but it's cyclical. And there are people who can't find the job they want. Yeah. So I say, well, start your own. Let me help you to start your own. So we've created something we've called Smarter Britain. It'll be live in about September. If you go onto the website now, smarterbritain.co.uk, there's just a holding page. But our objective is to help young people, and not just young people, you know, people who may have been retired or made redundant, who say, well, I can't get a job. Well, let's build my own. Oh, but I don't know how to do that. Okay, well, let us help you to do that. And so the big idea there is to help to create 1,000 jobs in 1,000 days. And again, people say to me, you're nuts. I say, no, I'm not actually, because I've done this once. We built this in South Africa. I've got some businesses in South Africa. I love South Africa. I've got some businesses in South Africa. And we built something down there called the Angels, angelsinc.co.za. And that was about helping subsistence entrepreneurs who were in very poor townships and money was very, very tight, and they were reliant upon government handouts or, frankly, begging. And we said, well, let us help you to create something of commercial value. And so we've trained, say that we started off mostly women. They were mostly ladies, little gardening businesses or little clothes businesses or just all kinds of things. Mm. Now we've now passed 10,000 entrepreneurs who we've trained and developed. And it's had a transformatory effect on their communities, because for every single wage earner, the cascade is down to about 30 people of financial benefit.
Yeah.
So if we can get 3 or 4 or 5 new businesses into a village, you know, you're covering the whole village. So we've already done it in South Africa. So I'm kind of bringing the model here. It'll be different here, but I'm really excited. I've got a school organization called UTC, University Technical Colleges, who want to put students through it. I've got the University of Surrey who want to take students from it and put them onto short entrepreneur degree programs and create the next generation of entrepreneurs. So that's the next big idea, which we've been at for about 12 months. We'll launch it shortly, as I said, but it's just very exciting.
That is very exciting. And no doubt there you are passing on some of what you've learned.
Yeah, I'm passing on what I've learned. But, you know, I've been helped by incredibly generous entrepreneurs. When I've gone out to kind of my network and said, look, here's what I'm doing. I need people to come and work with me in classrooms. I'm not paying you. I want you to come in and give me a couple of days of your time. I am overrun with volunteers. It's wonderful.
Amazing.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
Brilliant. So have you always, as far back as you can remember, been this imaginative of coming up with the next exciting idea?
Well, you know, I don't think it's imaginative. I just kind of go from one challenge or opportunity to the next. And I see things. And I think if I'm being less than modest, the only difference between me and a lot of people who I know is when I see something, I go and do it. Well, they see something, they look at it, and then they go, oh, yeah, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? And they go somewhere else. And I just go and do it. Because it's there, you know, it's a challenge. It's the famous, why did you climb that mountain? Well, because it was there. Why did you create that business? Well, because that opportunity was there.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think I'm nuts. You know, I took a photograph last Friday evening at 10:30. I was sitting here in this chair in my office working away on Smarter Britain. And I took a photograph because people say to me, what's the secret of success? And I always say to them, well, call me from your office at 10:30 on a Friday night, and I'll tell you the secret of success. And strangely enough, nobody ever calls me, but I'm still here. I'm still working at 10:30 on a Friday night because I'm passionate about what I do. So it doesn't feel like hard work.
Yeah.
You know, it's when you enjoy it, it doesn't feel like hard work.
Yeah, I get that completely. And in the way that you're describing all these things that you've done, the way it sounds, listening to it, is You've seen something that's there that could be done. You've identified whether it excites you or not. And if it does, you go and do it. And if it doesn't, you look for something else. So that, in other words, the things that you're putting your energy into, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like the things you're putting your energy into are the things you want to put your energy into. And therefore, it's that connect thing, isn't it?
You're absolutely connected, right,
with your mission, and therefore you are then excited and creative within it.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. And it's about your own personal values as well. I mean, there are certain businesses that I've walked away from. I was invited to go and help to build a betting company. And I said, no. And they said, but, you know, it'll be this big and you'll make this much money. I said, yeah, but I'm sorry. Anyone who wants to bet, good luck to them. But to me, the betting company always wins. So the punter always loses eventually. I don't want to be part of it. I don't want anything to do with it. So I'm not doing it. And the chap who was trying to recruit me was a good friend of mine, professional recruiter, very good friend of mine. He said, Kev, I don't get it. I said, Ian, it comes down to my personal values. I do not want to be involved in that business. I just don't want to do it. So there are things I won't do, but they're never things I won't do because they're too tough. It's if they don't relate to my values, I won't do it. But if it's a challenge, yeah, okay, it's a challenge. Fine. Rowing an ocean's a big challenge, but we did it. And you know what? The new boat will be parked outside my office a month from now, and we'll start preparing it for 2024 to row the Pacific. And I'm excited about it. I'm actually excited about it. I mean, people keep telling me, Kev, the Pacific's a lot bigger and the waves are a lot bigger. And I said, listen, when you face waves in the middle of the Atlantic that are towering above you, and we got turned over, we capsized the boat right in the middle, 1,500 miles from shore. We capsized the boat and we all ended up swimming, trying to get the boat the right way up. You know, that was a life-enhancing experience. Let's just put it that way. You don't forget it quickly when you're flapping around in the middle of the Atlantic with a boat that's upside down.
No.
And I actually felt sorry for the two guys who were a little cabin at each end of the boat where we sleep, and they're watertight cabins. And the electrical gears in there and stuff. But the two guys, Will and Chris, were fast asleep in these cabins, and the boat turned upside down, and they wondered what on earth was going on, because they were looking out a submarine world. we're swimming around trying to get the thing the right way up. They're locked in a cabin. They don't open the door, of course, because if they did, they'd flood the cabin. Potentially the boat would sink, which is really not good, 1,500 miles from shore. So, you know, it's a life-affirming experience.
Life-affirming. And I like the word you used as well earlier about the storm, where you said it got spicy there for a few moments. It was interesting.
Yeah, it got a bit spicy. I, as I said, structural engineer, and I was in the cabin when we got hit by the big waves, and I was listening to the boat, and I was waiting for it to start creaking. It's a glass fiber boat. And I was waiting for it to start creaking, because I knew if it was creaking, that meant it was twisting, which meant it was going to break up. Mm. So we were hammered by this storm. And I was in this little tiny cabin, and I'd taken all my wet gear off. I'd finished my shift. I'd gone into the cabin. And I'm listening, and the boat is just all over the place, just being tossed around like a cork. And the noise is tremendous, because you've got 1,000 tons of water hitting you, you know, in each wave. I sat in the cabin and thought, I'll just take my wet gear off. I've just taken my safety harness off. I've just taken my personal beacon off. I'm going to try and get some sleep, but I'm not going to get sleep because I'm being bounced around. I think I'll just put all my gear back on. So I got dressed again, put all my wet gear back on, put my safety harness back on, put my personal beacon on, which, you know, if we got lost from the boat, then theoretically the rescue services could find the beacon.
Yeah.
You'd be dead when they got there, but they could find you. And I sat in this little cabin thinking, if this goes down, I've got to get out through that little door. I've got this 30-kilogram bag here, which is our survival bag, which has got everything in that we need if we're going to get into life raft. And I sat there for 2 hours plotting how I was going to get out of this thing alive with this bag. But I'm here telling you the story, so it was fine.
You survived it. And I'll bet there was, I'll bet, you know, it can get hairy in the boardroom, but it probably doesn't ever get as hairy as it did that day on the Atlantic.
Well, when I speak to audiences and they have an impression of what Porsche was like, you know, and they think it was all very, very successful forever. And I said, well, if I tell you that my first board meeting, my finance director and my parts director were fist fighting on the floor, knocking lumps out of each other.
Only the automotive industry.
That was my first board meeting. And people go, oh, wow. I say, yeah, that's how bad things had got. That's how, that was the level of teamwork that we didn't have. And you know what? Those guys stayed in the business and we all became a team and we turned it around. But the day I was appointed was, oh my goodness me, it was war. It really was war. I mean, we were being killed. We had to turn it around.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I think it's great that you're doing this. What did you call it? Smarter Britain?
Smarter Britain, yeah.
I think it's great that you're doing that because I think that we all learn things as we go through life, and some of us are particularly creative. You've been particularly creative and you've learned an awful lot. And I always think it's a bit of a crime if that learning doesn't get passed on. So you're really taking that to the other end of the extreme. You're saying, I'm not just going to pass this on to a few people I'm mentoring. I'm going to pass this on to thousands of people and help them to get
going. And that's the critical thing. I was explaining to somebody recently, I went and did a presentation about it, and they said, well, there are already incubators and accelerators and stuff. I said, yeah, there are. And they tend to focus on the top 1% of the 1% of the techie ideas that they think are going to turn into, you know, unicorn billion-dollar valuation businesses.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's fine for that tiny, tiny percentage of people. But what about the other end of the telescope, where there's millions of people or hundreds of thousands of students come out of school every year, and some go into a job and some go into further education and some don't know what to do? It doesn't mean they're not capable. It just means they don't know what to do. So what if we could inspire them and excite them to say, build your own business? What would you like to do? Well, I'd like to be. And the example I use is people say, oh, and for some reason, everyone thinks computers. I said, no, forget computers for a minute. I said, imagine we bought somebody a ladder and a bucket and a wash lever and said, those streets there, they haven't got a window cleaner. Why don't you go and start a window cleaning round? And you don't need technology for that. You can go and do it and you go and build a business. Or we teach somebody, show somebody how to start a plumbing business, you know, get their qualifications. I mean, for goodness sake, try getting a plumber at the moment. Yeah. You know, my plumber here, he's got two Porsches. He's doing all right. Thank you very much. So I'm looking really at the other end of the telescope where there are a lot of people who often are not inspired and have not been engaged by schools for whatever reason. I'm not criticizing anybody, but they may just, it just didn't work for them. How can we help them to do what they'd really like to do if they want to run their own business? Yeah. And we'll help them over to get over the hurdles. 1,000 businesses in 1,000 days, every 1,000 days. So it's exciting.
It's very exciting.
And imagine, I said something the other day, I was getting so excited. I was presenting it to a school. I said, and imagine in 3 years' time when those students come back and they've got a business that they built and they come back and they inspire the next generation. I said, this is self-perpetuating. Again, I always say, all I do is create the framework, create the big idea, create the framework, and then I rely on really clever people to put all the detail in it.
Yeah.
But if you can get entrepreneurs to become successful, they are the detail because they will come back and they'll inspire the next generation.
Yeah.
So you know, it is exciting. I am excited by it.
I think it's
it's my legacy project. You know, people say to me, what are you going to do when you retire? And I say, well, I'm never going to retire. But what I will do is I'll still speak at conferences. I speak all over the world now on leadership. I'll still write books, but I want to run Smarter Britain. I want to have a really effective organization that generates entrepreneurs, because you know, in this country whatever you think of Brexit, whatever you think of the government, whatever, 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 90% of employees in this country work for small and medium enterprises. Mm. Everyone thinks they work for big companies. They don't. 90% of people work for small or medium companies. And we need, as a nation, we need to have that fresh supply of small, medium companies to continue to grow, to drive the commercial value of the country, drive GDP, make sure we do have enough money for the NHS, for schools, for roads, for infrastructure, for everything we need. That money doesn't produce itself. And if you're going to tax people, people have got to earn. How do you earn? Well, let's create businesses to pay tax to create a stable and worthwhile economy. So yeah, that's how I look at it.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. So yeah, this is a brilliant conversation, Kevin. I'm really enjoying it. And it's good, extremely valuable. You know, I think this is going to be very valuable for listeners. I'm going to just slightly shift the direction now and say, if you look out at the world with all the challenges, there are one or two challenges going on at the moment in the world, and everyone trying to deal with those challenges.
Yeah.
And if you think about what is it that I wish people would think about more, or what is it that I wish people would engage with more at the moment in the world in relation to all of these challenges that we are living with and facing? Do you have any kind of answer to that question?
I think the answer to that comes from my frustration, which is you've got one political party saying, well, we go left, 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 and the other one said we go right, right, right. And actually, the answer is somewhere in the middle. The true answer is somewhere in the middle. I get frustrated by politicians who seem to just want personal power. And, you know, you can look around the UK as it stands and get incredibly frustrated by politicians who seem to be creating issues in order to solve the issue, in order to show how clever they are. And I just think it's noise. So for me, what would I do if I could wave a magic wand? Well, I'd calm down some of the rhetoric in the political process. I think we have a severe lack of leadership there. And whatever people think of Boris and Starmer and all of them, I don't see anybody who I would employ to run a substantial business. Yeah. Wouldn't employ any of them. And I think if you're the prime minister of this country, you are the chief executive of, you know, Great Britain PLC. And therefore, I would expect to see a degree of leadership, and I'm not seeing that leadership at the minute. So that frustrates me. As a businessman, it frustrates me.
Yeah.
So people say, well, why don't you go and run for politics then? And I said, because I honestly, there comes a point when I think there aren't enough years left in my life to be able to go and calm down the current political noise to a level where I think it would be constructive if it were just me. So I've never thought of becoming a politician. But politics frustrates me. Mm. Obviously, the environmental issues are key. And the sooner we move to green energy and away from hydrocarbon, the better. I do, again, get frustrated. We're talking about putting 30 million electric vehicles on the road in the UK. Yeah, okay. Where's the infrastructure to power that? Mm. If you live in London right now or a major city and your parking spot is on the street at the end of your garden, how are you going to charge your car? Where are you going to do it? Because most people want to do it overnight. You're going to run cables across the pavements. So I get frustrated by the lack of joined up thinking. I think that, yeah, you know, in business, there was a comment made this morning by Sugar, apparently, Alan Sugar, to say, you know, working at home is lazy. I don't think it's lazy at all. I work at home. My office is at home. I work long, long hours, as I said earlier on. I think what is lazy is that many companies have not yet, are still using the excuse of COVID now for deficiencies in their systems. Whereas the smarter businesses, and I would include us in that because we've worked really hard to be agile and create systems and processes, which mean that our teams can work from home if they want to. And you know, you don't know, we're talking to each other now. I actually don't know where you are. I'm in Newbury in Berkshire. I don't know where you are, but we're talking.
Wales.
Well, there you go. So we're talking to each other through this medium. And so working at home for me is part of the future, because too many people spend too much time commuting. But it has to be hybrid, because you can't build a team by working remotely. That's my belief, my experience. So there are times we do need to get together. So, you know, for me, the future of work is a big issue. The future of technology, I get dismayed by social media and the noise. So everybody has an opinion. There's just too many opinions. Everyone's always had an opinion, but just keep it to yourself a bit. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to go onto social media and shout at somebody else. You don't need to. Mm. We won't always agree. We'll have a different opinion. And that's absolutely fine. We are sentient beings. We are thoughtful individuals. We have a view. No problem. You have your view. I have my view. We can discuss it. We can agree to agree, or we can agree to disagree.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're, I think, any less of you. But I don't need you to go onto Twitter or wherever and shout at other people. It's just unnecessary. So I do worry about that. And I do worry about the influence of social media on the younger generations, because I think it distorts. I think it distorts life. I really do. I think young people are growing up with a distorted view of the real world, because they're reading the world through a lens that their social media platform has chosen for them.
Yeah.
So I do worry about that. So what would I do if you know, use Boris's term, I was king of the world? Well, if I was CEO of the world, I'd have people looking on that. I'd have people looking into these issues. I'd have teams working on these issues.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, we can't ignore the Ukraine. I mean, I've done a lot of work in Ukraine. I've got friends in Ukraine. I've got an unanswered email from a Ukrainian friend in my inbox this morning. I feel guilty. I haven't gone straight back to her. It's, you know, I don't know. What is the answer? Well, the answer is the general view in the world is that Putin is off his trolley. But, you know, with the power of communication that he's got at his disposal, he's bringing a lot of people along with him. And that's equally concerning. So I absolutely believe in freedom of the press. It's the only way you get a balanced view of the world. You'll always have the outliers. There'll always be the radical left and the radical right. But let's make it all open. And if it's all open, people can make their own judgments.
Yeah.
So I'd have somebody else working. I'd have somebody else working on open communication, which is, again, comes back to the business. How do we run our businesses effectively? The phrase we use is one version of the truth. There is only ever one. There's only one version of the truth. The truth is the truth. So in our businesses, we've always been very open about where the business is at and where we want to go. We don't play games. We don't hide numbers. We don't hide things. We're just very open. And it's sometimes a very difficult message to put across. But it's the only way you will ever clean up a difficult situation is to be completely honest about it.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's lots to do. Lots to do.
Lots to do. And so, another thing, often when you're talking, Kevin, there's a kind of theme that comes through that suggests itself to me. And one that's just come through is the one of keeping the noise down. You know, when you said calming the rhetoric in the political arena, keeping the noise down in regard to overcomplicated planning, social media. And clearly you're somebody who's able to think clearly. And I'm getting the impression that one of the reasons for that is because you do keep the noise down. You are able to think.
Well, I've got a particular advantage in that regard, which is I'm not very bright. I can't concentrate on many things at once. So when I'm coaching management teams and we're talking about the priorities in the business, I force them to prioritize three ways, and then we keep the 25%. So we dump 75% of the stuff that they thought was important. Because my argument is, you're never going to get to it anyway. And if we fix the 25%, it's going to make the real difference. Well, you're very welcome to go back into the 75% and find some more stuff to do.
Yeah.
But let's get the noise out. Because when you've got too much going on, in an organization or in a business or anywhere.
Or in your it's head.
Noise. Yeah, in your head. It's just noise. And you can't get stuff done. Yeah. You know, I'm sure we all have days. I certainly have days where I come in here into the office. I think, oh, my goodness, I've got so much to do today. I don't know where to start. You know, what's first? Well, that's noise.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have my own little process. I sit down, I write my list. I go through my list and I cross out stuff that's actually that doesn't need to be done today. Cross out, cross out, cross out. And then I take a breath and I get on with it. But if I were to put the TV on over there and have the news channel running and I were to be monitoring social media and I'd be this, that, and the other, it's just too much noise. I mean, it was somebody this morning who sent me a note to say, have you seen what Sugar said about people who work at home? And I said, no, I haven't. They said, he said, it's they're just lazy. And I said, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But I don't agree with it for all the reasons I've said. Hybrid working is positive in some regards. And they said, would you like to give us a quote and we'll use it? And I said, well, I would, but I really can't be bothered because I'm just adding to the noise. I'll put it somewhere. I mean, I use LinkedIn and I'll put it on there, my views. But I'm not going to get into the tittle-tattle, the back and forth. You know, the press love to call me here and say, oh, have you seen what such and said? Would you like to respond? I say, no, thanks. No, thanks. It's just noise.
Yeah.
He can say whatever he likes and she can say whatever she likes. But all you're doing is whipping up a storm to fill column inches. I'm really not interested. Really not.
And what I've actually seen that post you're referring to. And my first thought was, the purpose of that post is to start an argument.
Yes.
Get lots of people talking.
Yes.
You know, which I think was fitted in with the example you were talking about of political rhetoric, where there's a lot of noise for the sake of the noise.
Yeah, you're right, for the noise. It fills column inches and fills TV slots. If I hear, I mean, I don't watch the TV, so boldly. I typically don't watch TV. I listen to the radio. I love the radio. But if I hear one more report on Partygate, yeah. Oh, my goodness me. You know, look, it is important that leaders live by the values and the rules that they set for others. Absolutely critical. And we all know what Boris is like. You know, I'm pretty neutral. I'm a conservative with a small C. I'm right in the middle. I want good schools. I want good education. I want good national health service. I want good infrastructure. I want people to be safe. I'm right in the middle there. But we know what he's like. So just stop. There's no value in telling me that he's broken another rule because I've already factored that in. And then Starmer on the other side, you know, and I just, honestly, it just drives me nuts. Yeah. There are bigger things in the world to sort out. We've got people dying in this country because of cold. We've got people, children who, you know, don't get proper education, children who don't get proper health support. All, you know, we've got big stuff to sort out. So let's get on with the big stuff. Yeah, and by all means, they should be subject to the rules. I get that. But how long's it been going on? TV's been full of it for what, 3 months? It's just a nonsense.
And it didn't start until quite a long time after the Christmas in question.
No.
You know, so it started at the time where it was in someone's interest for it to start, as far as I can tell. And I think that, again, that's that thing you said about rhetoric, which is completely different from your approach that you're talking about, where you connect into the thing that excites you and you do it and you do it honestly and you do it if it fits with your values. And that's a very straightforward way of being. But it's also a very energy efficient way of being, isn't it? Because you're not fighting with yourself as you're doing it. You're in alignment with yourself as you do it. So naturally, you've got more enthusiasm and naturally it's easier to be honest.
Yes. And you can be honest and it simplifies the world. You know, I'm all about simplifying stuff.
Yeah.
And we come back to the noise argument. So, yeah, I get frustrated by the political process, very frustrated.
Yeah, it could be worse. You could actually be stuck in there with them. You know, I always think, yes, I get frustrated by that, but it could be worse. I could be actually doing that as a job. That would be worse.
Well, I tell you where I find it, where the rubber hits the road, as it were, is we're building Smarter Britain. We want to build 1,000 businesses in 1,000 days, I keep saying. I wish somebody would show me how to get a sensible response from the government, who've allegedly put £2 billion into a grant to help create new businesses. Can I get anybody to talk to me sensibly? No. Right. And I just think, what is there, with all due respect, what is there that's more pertinent, that is more accurately reflective of your ambition for that funding than me helping young people to create 1,000 businesses? You tell me something that's more directly appropriate, because I can't see it. But at the minute, I can't find a way to get access to those funds. And I want those funds to help me build a platform. At the minute, I'm building it myself. I'm paying for it myself. But there'll come a point when it's of a scale that I won't be able to afford it. And it won't be, we're not talking about spending millions here, but we are talking about creating something of substance and of value that helps a lot of people to change their lives and helps this country to change its economy and change its culture, all for the good. But I find it incredibly frustrating that dealing with the body who is supposedly looking after those funds is just so difficult. It's just so difficult. I've been at it for 12 months. I'm going anywhere.
So if anyone listening to this episode has any suggestions for Kevin on that, get in touch.
Please do. I mean, I've got people who are offering to, oh, we're going to get you a grant, but you pay us X tens of thousands up front. And I'm saying, I'm not doing that.
No.
I'm not doing that. I'm paying you money that you might then go and do the same that I've done and got nowhere. So, you know, there are things like that, just simple stuff. And I lived in Switzerland for 8 years. I built a big data company in Switzerland. And it became the world's biggest automotive data company. At the end, when I left it, when we sold it, we were in 31 countries. So it became a big old business. And it was in Switzerland because the guy who started it was Swiss and he was based in Switzerland. So I went over to pick up this business and develop it. But, you know, Switzerland is such, A, it's a beautiful place. B, the rules are the rules are the rules. And if you get it wrong, you're in trouble. But C, it is so straightforward. It is straightforward. You do your tax return, you take it to the local Gemeinde, the local town hall, you hand it over across a desk and somebody checks it with you and they say, thank you very much. And 3 days later, either they owe you money or you owe them money and it's done. I mean, it is local and it's local and therefore it's relevant. And the budget, my first experience of the budget for the town was when I first went there. I was staying in the big hotel in the town. I came down to the bar in the evening, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people in reception wondering what was going on. And they said, oh, it's the village budget. The village budget. Yeah, we're presenting the village budget today. So they present, so the town council present, and everybody turns up. The whole village turns up. Because it's our taxes, we want to know where you're spending it and what you're doing with it. And so you have a sensible and seasoned discussion about where the funds are going. So again, takes the noise out. So I'm running this business, which becomes the biggest employer in the region. And one of the challenges we had was car parking. And so the mayor and his finance director came in to see us because they visit all the businesses in the region. And he said, we'd like to see your 3-year plan, which is like a bit weird. You know, politicians saying, show us your 3-year plan. Okay. So we shared our 3-year plan and they said, you're going to grow. We said, yeah, we're growing quite strongly. And they said, and what's your restriction on growth? Because we're a very important employer in the area by now. And we said, you know, to be honest, we're struggling for car park space because of where this office block was. And they said, okay, yeah, that's always a problem around here. Okay. And away they went. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. That's a waste of 3 hours of my life. Following day, they called us back and they said, listen, we've been and done negotiation with local sports hall and with this and that and the other, and we're going to put an extra bus on to the other end of the village and we'll give you parking there. So how's that? It's like, you just fixed all my problems. It was sensible local governance.
Yeah.
And it was such a pleasure.
Yeah.
Such a pleasure. And, you know, they were helping us to grow because we were creating employment and value in their territory, in their area.
Yeah.
So it was important to them. It was important to us. So that's when it works. That's what I like to see.
Yeah, yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So there's so much that's so rich in this whole conversation, Kevin. I feel like when I listen back to it, if I have a notepad, I could probably write another book.
Yeah. You said be my today. Guest.
So if there are a lot of leaders nowadays trying to do all sorts of things, and as we've said, dealing with the challenges in the world right now. And if one of these people has been listening to this conversation and they've loved it and they've resonated and they feel like they want to respond and act on some of what you've been saying, but they don't know where to start. They don't know what to do first. If they want to engage with some of these amazing big ideas that you've been talking about, what might you say to somebody like that?
I would say, drop me an email, come in through my website, kevingaskell.com, drop me an email and say you'd like to get together and talk about some of the stuff that, Kevin, you were barking on about on the on Catherine's podcast, and let's get together. And I'd say, fine, let's sit down together and let's discuss it. And you can explain to me the limitations that you're working to, and I'll explain to you the lack of limitations in my thinking. And let's see where the two can meet, because I said a while ago, most limitations in this world are self-imposed. People see a boundary and say, well, that's the end of it. No, it's not. No, that's where somebody else said it was the end. You can go further than that.
Yeah.
You know, it's the Muhammad Ali quote, impossible is just an opinion. It's just an opinion. If I had a pound for every time somebody told me that what I was going to do was impossible, I'd be a rich man. It's an opinion.
Yeah.
Kev, you can't row the ocean at the age of 60. Why? Why, you just can't? Well, I just did. And I'm going to do it again in 2 years' time. Oh, but you can't. Why can't I? You keep telling me I can't. Why not? I'm fit. I'm active. I'm experienced. I've done it once. I'm going to do it again. So when I sit with people in business, I play this game. I say, what is your ambition for the company? And they always tell me the same thing. They always tell me numbers. Oh, we want to grow at 4%. I say, no, that's not my answer. That's not the answer I'm looking for. What's your ambition for the company? What do you want it to be? What will it look like when it's successful? And eventually get, I say, okay, no, let's stick with numbers if you want. Right, so you just said 3%. You want to grow 3%? Yeah. Okay, well, the market's kind of 3% at the moment. How would you grow this business at 30%? And they look at me and they say, ooh, 30, ooh, blimey, ooh, Kev, ooh, 30. I say, all right, look, forget 30%. I get it that that's a bit challenging. And so they relax a bit. And I say, how would you grow it at 300%? And they say, you're crazy. I say, no. If I gave you all the resources you need, money, people, process, technology, whatever it is, what would you do to grow this business at 300%? And I actually don't care about the percentage. What I'm trying to do is get them to think beyond their self-imposed ceiling of 3 to 5%.
Yeah.
And so they start to talk about, well, we could move into that market and we'd do this and we'd change that. And I mean, I'm speaking, working with a company in a couple of weeks, and their big issue, they're number one in their market position, but they can't get the product to market. And this is nothing to do with Brexit or with COVID. They know their logistics systems are poor. And I said, so what are you doing to fix them? Well, you know, we move in. I said, no. Who's gone to them and said, listen, guys, instead of delivering 20% overnight, we want to be delivering 98% overnight. What are you going to do about it? And when you give people that kind of challenge, and you've got to think differently, you've got to break what you've got in order to build a better one, that's when the thinking starts coming. And what I find with businesses, with organizations in general, is when I force them to go through that process, and at the end we come up with, you know, our famous 25% list, which might be 10 things that need doing. And I say, which of those 10 are not in your control? None of them. Right. None. So what's stopping you doing it? Noise is stopping us doing it. We've never focused on them. We've been doing 100% of the stuff when actually we should be doing maybe 10 or 15 or 20% of the stuff and doing it properly and implementing it and making it work. And that's the difference. And that's how we build great businesses, because we do that 20%. And then we move on to the next 20% and the next 20%. We never run out of stuff to do.
Yeah.
But stop trying to do everything because you won't achieve it. It's noise. Everyone gets distracted.
Yeah. Well, so. I know I had a potential distraction for this podcast recording, which was a cat who's finally decided today that her life only has meaning if she has my full attention for the entire day. She's not always like this, but today she was walking around in front of the screen and I was pushing. In the end, I took her upstairs and shut her in the bedroom.
Good.
For 2 hours while we were recording this, because I just knew that distraction would just be a complete nightmare. Even if you didn't know she was there, even if you didn't notice, that would have distracted me. And yeah. It would have completely taken the edge off the whole conversation for me.
Well, it's little distractions, he said, picking up his telephone. So I'm just looking at my phone now.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of WhatsApp messages on there, right? Mm-hmm. And these will come from colleagues and friends. And they, as a result, they draw my attention.
Yeah.
And WhatsApp is the biggest, after Facebook, is the biggest absorber of management time because people are popping these little messages, which, frankly, don't need to be said. They just don't need to be said. And I said to somebody about it yesterday who had sent me during the day 8 or 9 or 10 messages. I said, I tell you what, don't do that tomorrow. If you want a response to those points, bring them all together, collate them, and call me at 5 o'clock tomorrow. I'm free at 5. Call me and we'll talk them through. And we'll fix it in 5 minutes instead of keep pinging into my phone.
Yeah.
Because I just don't want to do it. Yeah. I just don't want to do it. So there
well,
we go.
Kevin, this is great. I could keep talking to you forever if you would allow me to do so, because it's just so fascinating. But we're just coming up towards running out of time. If you think about this conversation we've had today, has there been for you a favourite part of this conversation?
I think the favourite part is it's always nice to just talk generally about business and about life. I mean, I just enjoy talking about it because people think business is so complex, and it's usually not. And the more you can simplify it, the better it is. I worked with a business last week, and I was speaking to the CEO before I went on stage. I was speaking, a keynote speech. And I said, what do you think your biggest problem is? And he said, we're too complex. We're just too complex. And he told me that they create engineering equipment, hydraulic equipment. And he said, you know, if you add up all the variables, he said, we can produce, I can't remember, a phenomenal number, 1,200,000 different of this thing. And he said, we've got it down to 12. And he said, and productivity's gone through the roof. And I said, well, it will, won't it? It will. And he said, yeah, but I've got to get that through the rest of the business. So I enjoy simplifying business. Business should be relatively straightforward. What is it that your customers want? What is it they're prepared to pay for? Provide it. Backstage, that's not for them to worry about. So I like talking about the philosophy around that. So I've enjoyed that conversation. Thank you.
Brilliant. Well, me too. It's been a real pleasure. And it was a pleasure to get to know you a little bit because we only just met. You know, I spotted you on LinkedIn and thought, this guy looks really interesting. I wonder if you'd mind if I just contacted him out of the blue. And you were very kind. You didn't say, who the hell are you? And why should I come onto your podcast? You just were very kind and said, yes, I'll come on. So it's been a real pleasure. Where would you like people to go if they want to find you?
So the first place to find me is the website, kevingaskell.com. And yeah. You'll get links to everything from there. But if you want to know more about the Atlantic Road, and the book is called Catching Giants.
Yeah, I shall put
Catching Giants relates to the fact that we were racing against Olympian oarsmen and we beat them. They were the giants and we beat them.
Amazing.
And then if you want to know more about my philosophy on business, then the book I wrote, which is called Inspired Leadership, is not a business. I mean, it is a business book, but it's got stories in there about how we actually do stuff and how we engage people and some of the characters I've met along the way. And it's designed to be a relatively easy read, to be honest.
Brilliant. Well, what I will do is I'll put your website address, kevingaskell.com, and I'll also put the Amazon links for both books
Great.
In the show notes so that people can find you, and then we'll just wait for the avalanche of people to contact you for a free conversation, like you just said. You know, I think it's very generous of you to say that someone can just contact you out of the blue and just talk to you.
Well, I get a lot of people just contact me out of the blue, and some I say, look, I can't help you with that, or that's not what I do, or whatever the situation is. And other people, where I can help them, I'll help them. And typically, that help may involve passing them on to somebody who's more appropriate than me to help them. So,
yeah, brilliant. Well, thanks again very much indeed, and have a beautiful day.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Truth and Transcendence, the regular weekly podcast from Yes, You Now with Catherine Llewellyn. For more information, head to yesyounow.today/podcast.